Focus with Jessica Strutt on ABC Radio Perth.
Truth. We get it drilled into us from a young age, don't we? Tell the truth. Be honest. Don't lie or your nose will grow long like Pinocchio's. But it seems there's been a decline of truth in our democracy, a rise of lies and misinformation. Today we're looking at what's contributing to that and how do we fix it? Do we need new laws, new journalism models, or perhaps new ways of thinking? In a world of increasing distrust in the media and in politicians, these issues have never been so fundamental to the health of our democracy. This special focus episode was recorded at the Disrupted Festival of Ideas over the weekend when I spoke with Dr. Jeff Gallop, former WA Premier and Emeritus Professor at the University of Sydney, Glyn Greensmith, a journalism lecturer at Curtin University and ABC broadcaster, and Nerelda Jacobs, a newsreader at 10 News Perth. I started by asking Glyn Greensmith what truth means to him and why it matters.
I want to do two very simple things, I think. I want to draw a line from the history of democracy to today, and then I want to kind of break things down into very simple ways, because this is about us, but this is very much about you and our engaged and informed democracy, I think. At the very beginning of democratic thought, Socrates was concerned. Here was this new idea. Let's let people vote. And Socrates was like, yeah, sure, that seems fine, but if people aren't engaged or informed, isn't giving them the vote a dangerous thing? If you're about to sail a ship out into a stormy ocean, are you going to vote on who you think is going to be the best person, or are you going to get a captain? And so he was really worried about this idea of democracy seems great, but if an electorate is uninformed, democracy will inevitably, in his view, lead to demagoguery. And as such, the ancient Greeks had a word that I really love, and it's idiotus. And I think we all know what word comes from idiotus, but it doesn't mean to us what it meant to them. Idiotus did not mean you weren't smart. It meant you were not informed in public affairs. Rich or poor, high IQ or low IQ, if you were not informed about what was going on around you, you're an idiot and you're a danger to democracy, as Socrates saw it. And I think you see that relationship there. Before the word journalism ever existed, you see the relationship between democracy and journalism, and that has never changed. It's 2,500 years old. Journalism in itself is brand new, but that fundamental relationship has always been there, and I think we forget that. Thomas Jefferson, who went on to become the president of the United States, not long before he became the US president, said, were I given the choice to live in a country without newspapers and a government, or a country with newspapers and no government, I would choose newspapers and no government. And he was the US president. He said it's more important that we know what's happening as a population than to have somebody at the top telling us what to do, before he became the person at the top telling us what to do. So the very nature of democracy relies on an informed electorate, relies on us not having too many idiotas. And so we bring that to today, and we're here talking about truth. What's that got to do with truth? Well, I think that we've lost the elemental relationship between journalism as a gatekeeper of democracy and politics as we see it today. When Jess says, what's truth? To me, truth today is a series of metrics. There's a price. We've put a price on truth, not a philosophical price, an actual dollar sign. We judge truth by its value. And what I mean by that is everything you see on TV is determined by ratings. Everything you hear on the radio is determined by ratings. Everything you see in the newspaper is determined by sales. Everything you read online is determined by clicks. Those are metrics. Those are numbers that we in the industry use to decide what to tell you and what not to tell you. What do you need to know? This is depressing. What do you want to know? Who's on Survivor? And that relationship, I think, is problematic. And I think one of the reasons it's problematic is that we've lost the compact, that you understand how we make decisions. You understand those metrics. To me, if you take journalism as a fundamental gatekeeper of democracy, then the metrics we use to define it are inadequate. If everything you see on television is determined by ratings, well, then in WA, that's 500 set-top boxes on televisions around this state. And that just doesn't cut it for me. Opinion polls, that just doesn't cut it for me.
Let's bring Nerelda in here. You're a working journalist. Yeah. And traditionally, we journos have been viewed as the truth tellers, the truth seekers.
Yep.
But there's increasing levels of distrust in the media. How do you see that playing out in day-to-day?
I think our day in the newsroom starts with meetings between our producers, journos, the chief of staff, and we decide what we're going to cover in the day for starters. Is it worth covering? And I think the fundamental for every story is there a public interest in covering the story? Is the public going to benefit? Do they need to hear this? And a lot of it is, do they want to hear it? Because, Glyn, as you rightly say, we need to have people tune in and it's sad or not a fact that a lot of people do choose to look at the fluffy dog stories over, you know, sometimes what they need to see and to know. And a good comparison is at the end of the day, we often put onto social media, our Facebook page and Twitter page, stories that we run during the day. And the most clicks, you know, you mentioned clickbait, the most clicks do happen for fluffy dog stories. Yesterday, we ran a story that Lego was opening a store in Perth. That got a lot of clicks. A lot of people were interested in this Lego store. And I see a lot of you going, oh, Lego's going to be opening in Perth. But then a story on, you know, constitutional change to recognise Aboriginal people in the Constitution may not have many clicks. And you might ask yourself, which is the need-to-know story? So it's a constant balance in the newsroom, but it has to start with that public interest as number one. That's the key. What do you need to know? But what we find out there is that what you choose to click on is usually not what you need to know, but what you want to know. So that's kind of what you were getting at with that balance.
Do we lead or do we follow? Do we give the people those stories because that's what we think they want, or do we give them to them because that's what they told us they want?
Yeah. Mm. So journalists play a role, but we're just one of the gatekeepers, Dr. Jeff Gallop. Run us through the other types that are out there and why they're so important in a discussion about truth. Yep.
The one thought I'd have about Thomas Jefferson is, though, that he didn't know about Rupert Murdoch, obviously, but I think we've entered a period of time in which what we understood to be the scientific paradigm, it might apply in terms of psychology, it might apply in terms of society, the environment, ecological sciences, psychological sciences, social sciences, which underpinned a lot of the things we did in government and in the community generally, that if you're going to do something, you need to have some basis of research or inquiry that leads you to conclude that what you're doing is in fact something that's going to achieve the objectives that you want. And so this scientific paradigm built up, it's underpinned all of our major institutions, and it's now under real attack. And it's under attack from the point of view of those who say, if I have a belief, I'm under no obligation whatsoever to look at the consequences of the application of that belief. And more so, I'm under no obligations whatsoever to consider other beliefs and the needs and interests perhaps of other people. And so it's a sort of self-enclosed bubble that's created to keep out this world that sends in inconvenient truths or sends in facts that contradict the opinions that might be had. And what we've done, and the point was made very well by Glenn, over the years in our democracy, we have various gatekeepers, he used the term. And these gatekeepers are there to make sure that when information goes out, it's valid and it's been well researched. There's always an element of doubt about some of the facts that we talk about. We might need new research. So we have the newsroom, we have the editors of newspapers who have a profession called journalism, and they try to work out when the news goes out that it's fair and reasonable. We have public servants who in government go to the government and say, that's an idea you picked up on talkback radio yesterday, but look, we tried it in 1955 and it was no good because the evidence tells us that. We have researchers in our universities, our academics, who study things deeply and are able to say, look, it's all very well to say that we need this particular framework of thinking. It might sound good, it might feel good, but it doesn't actually produce the results that you want. Hopefully as well, we have political leaders who have the capacity to think up the scale. And when decisions are being made in a cabinet, the decisions are good ones. So let me finish with this image. Imagine a cabinet room. They're sitting around, they're looking at an issue. Who's there? I think we've got, first of all, we've got the ideologues. The ideologues in a cabinet, they know what to do even before the issue gets put on the table. Their ideas are set. They are fundamentalists. Then you've got the people who go, what do the people want? What does the latest opinion poll tell us? That's what we should do. Then you've got the people who are in there working for vested interests. And they're there, usually, perhaps not even openly, but they're there trying to make sure that the interest they support is properly recognised in the final decision. Ideologues, fundamentalists, the opinion pollsters, and then the vested interests. Imagine that that's all that's there. There's no evidence. There's no one else at the table asking the question, if we do X, what will it mean? What do we know about the history of that subject? What do we know about the research that's been done about that subject? Imagine a world where evidence doesn't count. And I think it's a very, very dangerous world where there's no verification principles, no checks and balances. So that's my image of the post-truth, a world without evidence being used to make decisions.
You're listening to a forum about truth, which was recorded at Disrupted with former Premier Jeff Gallop, Curtin University journalism lecturer Glyn Greensmith, and Channel 10 newsreader Nerelda Jacobs. Jeff Gallop just took us into an imaginary cabinet meeting that was missing one of democracy's key checks and balances, a cabinet that might exist in a post-truth world. Next, Glyn Greensmith suggests our focus on Liberal versus Labor clouds the reality of democracy.
And it wasn't one, and it wasn't even Rupert Murdoch, God love him, sat in a room going, let's do it like this. It was kind of a gradual thing where the idea of journalism as the reporters of what was going on became entwined with politics rather than separated for democracy. And what I mean by that is, you know, every time I speak about politics, I know people are going, oh, I wonder if he votes Labour or Greens or Liberal. It's like, no. You know, there is more to democracy than the Republicans and the Democrats and bloody Liberal and Labour. Can we all start with that premise that democracy is more important than the two political parties who happen to have achieved dominance in any one country? And our inability to separate the reporting of politics from the, well, who are you telling me to vote for, is part of the reason that we've allowed this landscape to happen. And a lot of what is important about conversations like this is that there has been an implicit relationship between truth and democracy, I think, for 2,500 years. But implicit is not getting it done. And we need to take all of those ideas and make them explicit and hammer them and say them out loud.
But Nerelda Jacobs,
yep,
there are so many factors now impacting on journalists' ability to actually get to the truth.
I think election coverage at election time, and in Australia this last election, raised some really interesting questions. We had fake polls were being run. I'm happy to say
page.
That our newsroom didn't run that fake poll story, and there were a lot of red faces about that. We had opinion polls that suggested a landslide victory that didn't happen. So election coverage, are we going the way of, you know, America with this? You know, it raises some interesting questions, like the very source of news
opinion
is now questionable.
Opinion polls are 1,000 people usually. 1,000 people's opinion. And we've seen opinion polls been wrong for years, haven't we? We've seen a fairly catastrophic one where the mechanisms are outdated, therefore we get wrong results. But I don't care what you think about Kevin Rudd or Julia Gillard or Tony Abbott. Do we change prime ministers based on what 1,000 people are saying? Is that a fair way to say this is what our democracy should look like? Should we base truth on what 500 people are clicking? Or do we say we demand better metrics in the hope that it gives us better governance, in the hope that it gives us better truth? And I just think 1,000 people and what they've got to say, it's great to have an indication about what people think, and it's so important for people like Jeff. But if it's stopping, I can imagine Jeff being sat in a room and saying, oh, this has happened and I want to go talk about it. And some hack going, well, you can't say that, it won't poll well. Yeah. And the rest of us should be going, well, who cares?
Look, in a democracy, the people have to be involved. And we have their involvement under our current system through their direct action and activity in the community, running campaigns on this issue and that. We have it, of course, through the elections that put our representatives into Parliament and then into government. But underneath democracy, I think, is the concept of the public interest, and Nerelda used it when she was talking about the newsroom in the morning, working out what's in and what's out. The public interest is broader than just the majority interest, as the great John Stuart Mill told us back in the 19th century. It's a greater thing. It's something that we need to protect. And it's not easy to protect the public interest given these other interests that we had. But there are a couple of things we could do. First of all, I think, when the fake news has become an issue, and on the surface, it's a great thing to reflect upon. Unfortunately, it's being used by people who are covering up on the real intentions and nature of their own beliefs. They're saying it's fake news to criticise me because I want to say to four American women that they should go back to where they belong. It's fake news to say that there wasn't a wonderful number of people at a certain presidential inauguration, etc. This is something we really have to tackle, and because it's spreading into the system, not just spin. We know what spin is. Spin is when people exaggerate their argument, and in a sense, we're always going to have a bit of that in democracy because people will want to argue for what they want. We're always going to have some of that spin. But fake news, I think, is a different matter, and that needs to be addressed. Also what needs to be addressed, I think, is the way decisions are made. Deliberation, I think, is a wonderful concept. The idea, the evidence, the consideration, comparing your point of view with someone else. And that's why I've become a strong advocate for citizens' assemblies as a way to conduct deliberation, to try to take away the power from some of the vested interests in our society. So I think there's a lot of issues here. Fake news, we really need institutions and policies to take that out because it's polluting our system. Spin, we need more responsibility from our political leaders to talk the truth rather than to spin it around the edges. And I think we need more deliberation in the way that we make decisions. Proper deliberation. And it can happen. It's not as if it can't be achieved.
So politicians are, I mean, obviously, as I said, trust is dropping in politicians and there's more and more spin. Why do politicians lie?
Well, because they're in a very, it's a very competitive environment.
To be the best
liar?
To be the best liar?
Well, we've got to understand it's a very competitive situation and people find themselves...
What do you mean by competitive? Do you mean within, between
the politicians? Well, in our representative system of government, winning is everything. I mean, and so you've got a culture. I say there are a number of diseases that exist in the political realm. One of them is ministerialitis, where ministers think they know everything. Another one is departmentalitis, where the ministers do everything that the public service says, rather than take it on the board. But there's another one called electionitis. And I'm amazed at how people lose their sense of rationality in elections. And they do things they shouldn't do. They say things they shouldn't do because they're so excited by the context. In the hurly-burly of politics, lots of things are said that shouldn't be said, but people feel they have to because they want to win.
When you talk about that competitive environment, sometimes seems to me on the outside that the two parties have their internal factions. Drives me crazy listening to them talking about the left faction, the right faction, the Liberal Party. And it seems to me the way that they go about it is that they hate each other more than they hate the other party. That they'd rather lose a federal election than have somebody from the other faction of their own party win. So that competitiveness
Glenn, you haven't worked it out. The first rule of politics, never assume rationality.
Nerelda Jacobs, let's bring you in here. We were talking about the difficulty now for journalists to get to the truth. We know politicians, there's literally 20 spin doctors to every one journalist, I feel, at times. What are the other issues, though, confronting a working journalist? I mean, diminishing resources?
Numbers in the newsroom. Yeah, numbers in the newsroom is the number one factor. When I was out on the road, when you were Premier, that was probably the heyday of my experience in a newsroom. We would have like 11 journos on the road. Now we're lucky to have four journos on the road covering, you know, in a capital city like Perth. And the same numbers are growing now because Channel 10's been bought by CBS. Yay, we've got more resources. In fact, we're the best placed network of them all in Australia at the moment. But take the Seven West newsroom. They had a whole sweep of redundancies and have lost most of their most senior, experienced journalists. The ABC is suffering as well. We had 9 take over Fairfax newspapers. There was about 140 or so journos and staff that were made redundant Australia-wide. So we're trying to cover the same amount of news for the same geographical areas with fewer people. And so that means that there's less time to investigate stories, because we're simply reacting to stories, and we're just reacting to the news of the day rather than putting a lot of investigative hours into covering the story. So a lot of the time it's just journo's instincts on the ground, and unfortunately they're not as experienced as they probably were, but they're very enthusiastic and they've got loads of confidence and good training from what they get from Glyn and the like. So we just have to put faith in the journalists that we've got.
Glyn, what about media ownership though?
Yes.
A concentration of media ownership is another huge factor here.
It is.
I mean, in Perth we see it, we all see it. And the truth coming out, there's a lot of advertising revenue at stake, isn't there?
Never underestimate the power of just 2 people in a room. That's pretty much how every decision we take for granted has been made. And it really surprises me how often we take these things for granted. And media ownership was not designed like this. So even back in the 30s, the Australian government was like, oh, what is journalism? How should we regulate it? And they were like, well, if one person owns everything, that's not journalism. It took people to change that. It took Rupert Murdoch sitting down with Malcolm Fraser, then Rupert Murdoch sitting down with Bob Hawke, because all the best bastardry is bipartisan, and changing the laws. Oh, and then they changed them again really recently. Now, these were human beings making a decision in a room to undo the thing that was there because it was thought to be the best thing. And we've all just gone, yeah, okay. We're not going to vote on that. I know you're not going to vote on that.
We've touched on the media's obsession with clicks and in the cat video. It's always more popular than a story about corruption in politics, unfortunately. And we push what's popular over what might be in the public interest, okay? What about the role of social media in the decline of truth, Jeff? That is...
Well, when I was listening to Glenn, he was saying, you know, someone makes this happen, and of course... There are people who make decisions that undermine the public interest. But there is a technology issue here as well, a communications technology issue, where it's so easy now for people to say things, to join up with other people online, form their little groups without any questioning. There's no gatekeepers there. And, of course, the big challenge is to try and get some, and that's the debate we're having at the moment. But I think technology is a player in this. The very fact that anyone can say anything pretty well online, evil people have worked out that they can try and use it to influence elections as well. And you know, it is a technology that's also offered unbelievable opportunity to people. And, you know, I sort of, when I think of the world, I always see contradictions. There's always contradictions. There's never a perfect resolution of anything. And technology's been a wonderfully good thing, but it's also carried these risks attached to it. And so I'm not quite with Glenn when he says it's someone's made this decision to make this happen. Diversity of the media is needed. We don't want concentration, that's true. But there is another dynamic at work here, I think.
The internet is very young, and like a lot of young people, just needs a good lie down sometimes.
bit of a Bex.
A bit, yeah, just a little nap time for the internet, I think. We can all decide that the great promise of the human encyclopedia has turned into people shouting at each other. But still, it is people making decisions. And one of the great things I think the trap we shouldn't fall into is that the internet is... just this amorphous monster that cannot be contained. The Kraken is loose. That is, I just don't think that's true. I think it's unconstrained because we haven't asked yet. And now that we're seeing people ask, we're seeing it in New Zealand, our Prime Minister here has said, what can we do? That is the first step to trying to rein that in. But it's amazing how often we just refuse to ask the question because we kind of think, well, that's just it now.
Focus on the issues that affect you with Jess Strutt on ABC Radio Perth and on the ABC Listen app.
Where do you get your news and information from? Do you see stuff on social media that looks a bit whiffy? Do you do a bit of checking before you click like and share? These are a couple of ideas we explored at the Disrupted Festival of Ideas over the weekend. Joining me on the panel were former Premier Jeff Gallop, Curtin University's Glyn Greensmith,
and Channel 10 anchor Nerelda Jacobs. We rejoined them as they expressed their frustration with those social media apps that seem to rule our lives and our thinking.
Social media allows people to live in a bubble. We have a world of information at our fingertips, but we choose to only read and click on what we want to read and click on. And Israel Folau seems to me to be a prime example with his Twitter comments and social media comments and the people that follow him. And if you are a supporter of Israel Folau, then perhaps the algorithms will only allow you to see things, you know, that support his views. And so you may end up thinking that that is the only view. And that's the danger, because it allows us to live in the bubble that we want to live in, rather than accessing, you know, a news bulletin that will show you what other people are saying about Israel Folau, and perhaps, you know, challenge your thinking. So social media in that context is really dangerous. We had a situation. Did anybody see the Adam Goods documentary, The Final Quarter? Fantastic, wasn't it? I thought it was a must-see for all Australians, and it made me really passionate, and, you know, I was angry, and, you know, it was emotive and all of the things, you know. And it just made me feel so proud of Adam Goods and all of those people that stood up with him. Most of the comments that 10 Daily, Channel 10's website, got were people who slammed the documentary, slammed Adam Goods. And most of those didn't watch the documentary. You know, people are reading these comments thinking that's what most people think. So I'm not alone, you know. But so that's why social media in that context is so dangerous.
And Jeff, that goes into the point about this post-truth era. We're seeing this rise of abuse and hate speech by the uninformed.
I think we've discussed, you know, the technology. We've discussed the nature of fake news and post-truth and how it operates in the level. But I think we've got to take the discussion up a little bit as well. There are a lot of politics in all of this. And as I see it, not having that evidence person at the cabinet table, not taking into account, you know, the best thinking on an issue, slamming experts and all that, is reflective of a great challenge that's going on in our society at the moment. I think we defeated the fascist menace back in 1945. Communism eventually collapsed in the late 1980s. We thought it was all going to be great. You know, there'd be a perfect world would result, a democracy would spread, the third world would get the chance to trade more freely with the advanced industrial democracies, and everything would turn out okay. Then all of a sudden, there's been this massive assault on progress. It's a reactionary position. If you think about all of the values that we hold and the way that we look at things, that science matters, and science tells us something about climate change, some vested interests don't like that idea. We've seen women get more equality in our society. Sexism has been tackled. We've got the rights of gay and lesbian people have been given proper recognition in many communities. We see people of a non-English speaking background in our own country given certain rights under the framework of multiculturalism. We've seen more trade between different countries as a result of some of the international developments that occurred. And some people don't like this, either for vested interest reasons or ideological reasons, and they've worked out that in order to pursue their politics, they've got to undermine science. They have to undermine the values that our society has, because that society has created the idea of equality, has created the idea that we can work better as a community together. So post-truth actually is a paradigm for a whole group of right-wing populist types who are making a head-on assault against our modern society. And I think this is playing itself out in many parts of the world currently. I think it's a real, really negative development in our human history, because there's no reconciliation between those two sides. I mean, if you don't believe in scientific methodology, if you don't believe in human rights, rather, if you might believe in religious rights or social rights, but not human rights, it's very, very hard to get a dialogue with those that do. And as a certain president says, there are winners and there are losers, and I intend to be a winner.
And here's a great example of he's demanding that politics define your truth, when what we should have is truth defining your politics. And Jess used a great word a second ago that I really think ties into what you two are both saying when you talked about ill-informed and misinformed and the empowerment of ignorance that we've seen through our politics, because they're saying you be as ignorant as you want, as long as your ignorance gets a tick in my box, I'm happy. And I think we, again, have lost that compact of saying that being informed is an act of civic duty. I think you're more patriotic if you're informed. Couldn't care less who you vote for. If you are informed, you're more patriotic than somebody who, you know, gets a tattoo of a flag. And I think we've lost that. And the idiotus kind of tells us that it was never designed to be elitist. And we hear that word thrown out at us a lot. And I want to come just point to this bubble idea is so true. I'm fairly sure, and I'll only say this because I don't think he's listening because he lives in Northern England, I'm fairly sure my old man voted for Brexit. And he was out here at Christmas and we had the argument. He's Northern working class and he's very like Trump's constituency. Smart, engaged man, my father. And I didn't say for or against Brexit. I said, well, let's just look at the evidence. And he said, well, I reject that evidence. And I said, well, what about the lies? And he said, well, they all lie. They both are as bad as each other. And I was like, well, were they? And it was a really interesting conversation for me because, you know, we are, this idea of the bubble and often when you are presenting evidence, the very last thing people fall back on is, oh, you're just elitist. And it's like, oh, mate, that's such a hard thing to argue against. When I'm just saying I'm trying to get these bits of information, not for or against. And journalism, I think, has very much lost that ability to engage with those people, whereas politics, bad politicians, has done a very good job of engaging with those people.
Now, we don't want you to all go home depressed.
I mean, the world is depressing enough.
Let's create some hope. Let's look at what we as a community can do to help arrest this decline in truth and, I suppose, restore some faith in our politicians and in we the media. So we touched on the fact that the journalism business model doesn't seem to be working. Click, click, click. Cat video, cat video, cat video. I'm over it. Are you? Okay. It needs a major service. What needs to happen, Glenn?
There are great ideas all over the world right now about different ways we fund it. It starts with the simplest premise of all. Lots of people really understand the importance of journalism in a democracy. Really, really bad people understand the importance of journalism in a democracy. So we need to take it back and demand that we actually have different ways of funding it. There are hundreds of different ideas out there. And I've just come back from a journalism education conference in Paris, whatever, no big deal. Just drop that in. And it's just so great to see people having those ideas. The first thing I want to do is just say this. The fourth estate model. You've all heard this term. I don't know how familiar you are with it. It's an old term, but I'll give you sort of the new version. The first estate is government. The second estate is powerful institutions, which used to be religion, but probably still is. And you can put your big businesses in there. The third estate is the people. The fourth estate is journalism. And our job is to represent all of them to each other. Well, right now, we are controlled by governments and business. Well, let's just not. I don't want the Prime Minister of the day deciding what the ABC funding is. He's got no business. She's got no business. No business deciding ABC funding. Take it out. It's really not that hard when you try. When we have, and people can and should make money in a commercial environment, but the worth of journalism is more than the dollar sign. Can we, once we evolve that understanding, there are readily available ideas that aren't that complicated. It's, you know, the worth of your home is not the value of it on the market. It's your home. Journalism is a bit like that. And so what I would say is, without going into any of them specifically, and I was just over in Europe and we were looking at some of the different funding models in Germany. They just have like a direct debit that comes out of everyone's account, 20 euros a month, thank you very much, to pay for journalism. And some people hate it, and a lot of people just go, well, that's, we want a robust media environment. We understand that relationship. We're okay with that. There are lots of funding models. It's that starting, I'm half Irish, and we have a saying in Ireland that I think people think is a joke, but it's actually quite profound. In Ireland, they say, hey, Glenn, what's the way to Greencastle? They say, sure, it's easy to get to Greencastle. You just don't want to start from here. And that's what's happened with journalism and democracy.
Not all journalists are well-behaved, though. Not all media organisers are well-behaved. And, do we need to perhaps look at some sort of a better professional standards, independent oversight of journalism? You know, lawyers have the Legal Practice Board. Doctors have the Medical Board. Nerelda, do you think that we need to restore faith by actually having checks and balances on us?
I think it's important to label media outlets as tabloid journalism or journalism you can trust.
Public interest journalism.
Yes, because there are...
There's a mix up there, isn't there, at the moment?
Because there are newspapers that are heading towards tabloid journalism, and you can just kind of see the amount of photos and gossipy photos that are suddenly appearing on front pages. What direction is this paper heading, you know? So I think that's really important that we identify sources that we can continue to trust. And I would like to think our newsroom is one of those sources, the ABC is one of those sources.
It's great to see the journalists standing up for standards when, you know, there's a lot of pressure on them to dilute those standards and indeed to act not like journalists but as like politicians. You know, there's a big debate going on with Facebook and the other platforms about how they check up on fake news and whether or not it can be taken off before it's too seriously damaging through the community. There are codes of conduct that we can look at that. But I think there's another issue here that I'm very interested in these days, and that is I've presented to you a story where there's a sort of a war going on between two ways of thinking and two sorts of politics. And war is no good. I mean, obviously, living in a society where there's conflict at that level is not good, because at some point it'll burst out into real conflict of the physical sort where violence is involved. I'd say the three levels: professional standards through everything, some good policies to deal with the fake news and problem, and then thirdly, some good institutions that bring deliberation to the table.
What about the political realm? We've just talked about the problem of more lies seem to be told during elections now because you can get away with it, and the problems with opinion polls. We're obsessed with them in the media, unfortunately. Short of outlawing spin doctors, how do we restore truth from our politicians? Jeff?
There's a wonderful paper in the London Review of Books a couple of weeks ago by an English liberal conservative, Ferdinand Mount, talking about the history of Europe and how it came together as a union. And he talks about the wars that occurred, of course, the First and the Second World War, the battle over resources, partly a battle over resources, and how the first thing they did in Europe after the Second World War is to create the policies about coal, that they could better manage the resource in Europe so that people wouldn't want to go to war. And he points out that those that are now going for the Brexit are really, they're unthinking. They think the world's simple. There's no detail to their thinking. And I guess unless you believe that this is a very retrograde development that's occurring and you've got to do something about it as a politician, you're not going to take up the challenge. So I think we've got to start thinking, this is a very serious development. This is very serious. We're drifting, and the conflict that will come out at the other end will happen at some point. You know, trade wars, they always finish up in this sort of conflict.
Well, what about the idea of longer terms of government? Because you've already said, Jeff, earlier in the day, well, the focus is on winning,
constant
the next election. So would longer terms help the debate around, you know, fixing truth?
I think there should be four-year terms at our national level. I think it's silly that we've got the three, I agree, but I'm not sure that's the grand solution. Is it a good first step? Well, it's a step I support, but I'm not sure it's going to tackle post-truth. I think it's the degree of competition in the election that's going to determine the degree of misinformation that goes out and the professionalism of the people involved, and also the laws that require bringing accountability, you know, the sort of thing we're discussing over in New South Wales at the moment. There's a discussion over lobbying, how it works, how it should be properly regulated, etc. So I think, I think we need to do all of those sorts of things to try to get the system working better.
There's so much information overload these days, isn't there? I don't know about you, but sometimes my brain feels like it's going to explode. And
we do need cat videos every now and then. I mean, fair.
Not too many on the ABC yet. But the public do play a huge role in this fixing of truth and choosing what you give your attention to, thinking critically, being discerning about what you consume in terms of the media. how do we get the public on board? How do we get you on board, Jeff?
I think we talk about the distrust that people have towards governments. Elections aren't enough. They're not enough to get people back onto the team of democracy, freedom, tolerance, a better society. We've got to get them back. And I think deliberation and institutions like what the Irish have done is one way of doing that.
I would put it really simply. To be idiotus is an Australian. Like, we've seen that phrase an Australian used for all sorts of nefarious aims.
Can we get a car sticker for that?
Yeah.
You know, for the back
isn't
of the car
sticker? Isn't it a simple thing to say to be informed in a democracy is an act of civic duty? You're a patriot. Not who you vote for, but to be informed and to be engaged in your democracy is an act of patriotism. We've lost control of that phrase to the scoundrels. Take it back.
When the raids happened recently, the federal police raids on the ABC headquarters in Sydney and also on the News Limited journalist, where they were going through even her underwear drawer, sadly, but true. We have a US president as well who says things like journalists are the enemy of the people. How do we rein in attacks on the media? Is there a way to call that out? Is there anything more we can do than just call it out? It seems to me when the raids on the ABC happened, the talkback I was getting and texts to the ABC line, well, they deserved it. Yeah. They didn't have the right to share that information.
People did not care.
And I think that that information was so in the public interest. How do we correct that?
What is public interest? These ideas of subjectivity, what is journalism? What is it for? What is public interest? We've lost that because it's been implicit for too long. Make it explicit. This is who we are and what we do, and this is why it impacts you. To be fair, it shouldn't have to impact you directly for you to care, by the way, but it actually does.
We could look at legal changes here, legislative changes, but you're not a huge fan of moving down that way. You prefer the idea of promoting something, the idea around, you know, a Buddhist idea was what something you mentioned to me. Can we have a chat about that? I love that idea.
Well, I'm very interested in, you know, Buddhist concepts and how they relate to the individual within the community. And one of them is right speech. And it's interesting that we don't talk much about what is right speech. Occasionally it comes up if there's a defamation case or something that someone's posing or it's an extreme comment by a politician. But we need to encourage this. And that is, you know, not to spread information and lies, to not slander people, to listen to what other people are saying as part of the process as well, to listen more carefully at what they're saying, to not abuse them, to not be trivial and spread gossip just for the sake of it, which can get out of hand. This idea of speaking properly as a human being within the society, recognising that there are other people, it fits in with my idea too to have more deliberation in our system of government. And I've got this little mad idea. It would be nice to have a little monitor group, you know, that when people give speeches, to look at the speech and say, you know, to what extent was that according with the Buddhist principles of right speech? And, you know, how often they don't. How often they don't. Now, if you want to reduce the amount of hate in society, obviously you've got to reduce the amount of hateful speech. But you have to recognise that it's hateful. And I think one of the issues we have today is the freedom of speech movement, quote unquote, which it's very hard to argue against freedom of speech. But don't be under any illusions that a lot of those people defending a freedom of speech, what they're actually defending is hate speech. And I think we're losing this sense of what it means to speak properly. And so I think having a little monitor where we check up and point out whether or not people are engaging in right speech or wrong speech would be a useful addition, along with the fact checking is very important as well, along with that.
Nerelda, that would appeal to you, the idea that we, rather than get the big stick out, maybe a carrot, and we promote as a society, because this is all about the community getting involved. This is about you taking some responsibility and us to promote the idea of a society where right speech becomes the norm.
Yes, we all need to be, we all need to have a bit of a journalist in us. When we all need to be a gatekeeper. How many times have we shared information by saying, oh, I read, you know, such and such, or, you know, oh, I saw the other day, last night on the news, I watched this. And you're sharing it in good faith that it is true. You don't want to share something that is
exactly
not true.
You know, so that's why you need to get your news from a trusted source. Because, you know, so many times I'm out and about and my family or friends will go, oh, you know, I saw this on the news last night. And I can be very proud that I know what you have heard is the truth. But we can't say that about everything that we read. And so that's why we need to have that bit of a gatekeeper and be suspicious. We need to read things with a suspicious mind.
During the Second World War, George Orwell said that if I heard it on the radio, it means it was true. That was like the pub conversation. Oh, where did you hear that? I heard it on the radio.
Yeah.
That was a catchword for truth. Well, I'm not sure that applies today, but I would love that to
people
apply.
Say that I saw it on the news. You know, so if you see it on the news, it must be true.
And understanding that difference between public interest journalism and a news. So the entire bracket of what news is ridiculous and quite harmful. And what you were saying before about that separation of what is public interest journalism in the interests of democracy, as opposed to here's who somebody is sleeping with somewhere, or here's a seal that makes great fart noises. I would click on that, but I would go back to economic reports afterwards. So just understanding those differences is really crucial. And that's a really easy thing to say and a hard thing to enact, that idea of we as a society, isn't it? Because this is all individual people and we think, well, how do we do that? I think that's really interesting. What is that self-regulation that we take on ourselves and how do we start that? I was in Europe and in Amsterdam, they all ride bicycles. This sounds weird, I know, but bear with me. And it's so neat. And there's no rules about the bicycles and where they're parked. You all know but they clearly decided as a society that they would self-regulate how they're going to park their bikes because they love their town. And I looked at that and I thought, that's really interesting that they clearly made that decision. And when you bring it back to Perth, I had an interesting revelation. Can we not merge because we assume other people can't merge? Is that what's stopping us? If we just assumed we all could merge, could we merge?
What a great way to finish up Glyn Greensmith, Jeff Gallop and Relda Jacobs at the Disrupted Festival of Ideas at the weekend. Yes, you can merge. And you can wade through the murky landscape of media to find the truth if you know where to look.